Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. I got the whole gang here. Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the Los Angeles field office of the OIG and now a member of our SIU investigative team. Matt Kachansky, retired executive from HHS OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director and our senior manager on our SIU investigative team. Jason Eisengrind, Matt's counterpart at HHS OIG, the retired Western UPIC director and now our special director in charge working on special projects. And I am Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Support. Thanks, everybody. We've been getting a lot of really great feedback about the OIG roundtables. It's really amazing. Sometimes we don't get to see all of the metrics on how many times people watch these, but we are really getting some amazing feedback from the SIU investigative payer community. Even some of the people on the provider community are watching these podcasts, and we really appreciate the feedback that we're getting regarding the information that we're sharing based upon our collective years of experience. Me being the baby of the group with 30 years, but you know, I go to someone like Wade and who's got 35, close to 40 years, Matt and Jason, who are in you know, excess of 40 years. And so we really do try to bring you our collective experience and knowledge in the industry on this. So we really do appreciate the feedback, and please do continue to let us know. And in fact, today we're going to talk, we're going to revisit some stuff that we've talked about over the past probably year and a half or so of doing these podcasts. And we're going to talk about some of the ongoing work in COVID and some of the collateral investigative efforts going on from COVID, right? So while COVID is over, I guess, is the way to put it in that sense, right? I mean, there's still cases of COVID. It's still a thing, right? Vaccinations and testing and all of that, it's still a thing. But the, you know, the fraud investigative part is just really starting to ramp up. If you're reading press releases and you're reading work plans from the OIG in particular, you're seeing that there's still a fairly large amount of work being done on COVID. There's still the COVID task force. There's the PRAC, Pandemic Response Accountability Committee. That's still out there. There's a large budget on that. HRSA is still doing a lot of work with respect to COVID. And so it's still out there. And really, the important piece of it is that while the public health emergency was in place, CMS had put a moratorium on investigations. And so a lot of the UPICs had to put both feet on the brakes and stop the car from being able to do these kinds of investigations. A lot of the commercial payers, a lot of the MCOs were similarly situated in doing that. And so now, while we're out of COVID in that regard, and a lot of the money that was spent for COVID is gone, a lot of that work is just really starting to ramp up. So, you know, there's all kinds of stuff. There were policy changes, and there were different trends and different fraud schemes that came up. And for those of you who are in the coding auditing world, you know for sure that when the PHE first kicked in March of 2020. And a lot of those rules were relaxed, things like the 1135 waivers and some of the changes with regards to modifiers that were put on and some of the two-letter modifiers that were put on. And, you know, now there's numeric modifiers and things of that sort. It's a constantly moving ball. And we talk about this in the collective when we're having conversations regarding prosecutions and the constant moving ball in the prosecution, that a prosecutor might say to you, hey, get me XYZ. You do your investigation, you identify X, Y, and Z, and then they come back and they say, okay, get me A, B, and C. That constantly moving ball from the investigative part, particularly with COVID, continues to exist because of the policies and the shifting policies and the change in policies and things of that sort. So, Wade, I want to pick on you for a good portion of this because you spent the past several years embedded on a couple of our SIU contracts doing a lot of this work, and particularly with regard to some work in the Medicaid space. But, you know, the big thing that I see when we talk about these cases is the need to stay mission focused, not go down the rabbit hole and understand a lot of the key parts of the PHE and those timelines, and the need to stay focused on the different time frames that were there, right? Because different time frames created different policies, different nuances. What was going to be paid? In some instances, it was bundled payments. If you go in for a COVID test, you're getting one payment that includes the E&M and the payment and things of that sort. So talk a little bit, because there are a few areas, particularly in the Medicaid space, and I want you to talk about them and define them. There's MLTSS, there's AMDC, and PMDC. So let's talk about what are those and how does that all work when we're talking about these kinds of cases?
Sure. And I think a couple things to like start with. A lot of stuff that I will discuss is kind of like Captain Obvious stuff, but I think it's a good reminder, especially the dates, because I think it's easy to forget that this COVID situation has been going on for 4 years. And if you ask someone, a lot of people think, oh, it's been like 2 years, maybe 3 years. It's been 4 years since the PHE has been out there. It was first discussed that they were going to do it in January of 2020, January 27, I think it was, the CDC first talked about it. And then it kind of became official in March, where they made a lot of changes to the regulations, and they eased a lot of the regulations. And you discussed like some of the things that CMS did, but that kind of filtered down from you know, ultimately HHS and CDC and NIH down to CMS and then to the state MCOs. So they all kind of got permissions to, adjust things. So those are the key dates. There's other ones about like when vaccines became available and things of that nature. But really the main ones for investigative purposes is really the start of COVID and the PHE dates and more specifically when those regulations were changed. So you discussed MLTSS, which is manage long-term services and support. And they operate a lot of the like long-term care facilities. The other acronyms you threw out were PMDC, pediatric medical daycare. AMDC is adult medical daycare. And these are two of the areas that I saw a lot of investigative activity during, the last couple of years. And again, it's important if you're looking at the regulations, if you're used to looking at these types of cases prior to January of 2020 when COVID hit, they were pretty strict regulations on what had to be done in order to get paid. And a lot of it had to do with recording of time. So in adult daycare centers, the members had to be there for, and it varied by state and different MCO kind of jurisdictions, but some places they had to be there almost 8 hours a day, but most places they had to be there in excess of 4 hours a day. So there was sign-in sheets. That's one of the things you'd look at, were the members there for more than 4 hours a day? If they were, they get paid a per diem for that whole day. And for the adult daycare that was not medical in nature, it was just kind of a place for them to go and play bingo, and they'd have food catered in and that type of thing. It was just kind of a place for them to go during the day for people that needed that. And it didn't pay a lot. It paid, between $60 and $80 a day. So I think $78 was one of the main areas. When you get into the pediatric medical daycare, there was more care given. They had nurses on board, and there was medical care given. So that was paid in a different amounts, which was usually in the $360 to $400 range. So a vast difference in the two programs. But when COVID came along and MLTSS kind of rewrote the regulations, the time recording was no longer an issue, because all that was required in both cases, in the medical daycare and the adult social daycare, was the daycare provider had to do, and this was the other area that the way the regulation was written was terrible, because if you looked at it on its face, it said you had to do these three things. You had to make a telephone call to check on the member to see if they were okay, if they had COVID symptoms, if they had a test, if they needed food, just kind of housekeeping type things. So the first thing is that phone call. Positive contact, you can't leave a message. The second thing was they would deliver supposed to be meals. There's a question as to whether a bag of tortillas and a pound of dry beans is a meal, but they're delivering food anyways. So they had to deliver meals, food, and or activities. They would give them just basically things to keep them busy. It might be puzzles, it might be games, that type of thing. So that's the second thing. Or the third thing And actually, the way it was written, it says you have to do 1, 2, and number 3, which is an in-person visit. Now, we didn't look at it in looking at cases. There's no, if you're doing a telephone contact and you're delivering food, the and should really be an or, because you really need to do one of those things. You don't need to do all three of those things. And there was a lot of arguments back and forth as to whether it was supposed to be the way it was written, or if that and was meant to be an or, which we looked at the cases like we're not going to require them to do all three things, because you would basically have 100% overpayment because nobody was doing all three of those things. And it was just the way they were written. It wasn't required. If you could get a hold of them on the phone, the nature of the regulation was you don't need to meet them in person because you've checked in on them. And if you've given them food, you don't need to again meet with them. And early on, we were trying not to do that because of, you know, the masking, and the whole purpose was to not have people face to face. So we looked at those kind of referrals as, did they do either a telephone call, a delivery of food, or an in-person face-to-face visit. And, you know, what they would normally have to do to get their per diem was much more in depth than these three elements that they could do during COVID. They could make a phone call and talk to the member or the member's, you know, representative if they weren't able to represent themselves, and have a 3-minute conversation. And as long as they documented that, and they didn't have a, you know, there was a lot of different variations where they'd have a checklist, and we kind of looked at those. Are these legit? Did they really have these phone calls? But they just had to do one of those three items to get the full per diem pay. And for the pediatric medical daycare, a 3-minute phone call could net you $400 in legitimate payments. But people got lazy and they just weren't doing them. There was a lot of places where we'd cross records and we'd have the claims data, and we know that they're billing for a daily per diem 5 days a week, and they just wouldn't have any records. They wouldn't even bother to have the notation that I spoke to this person for 5 minutes and everything's fine. They didn't even bother to do that. We made it so easy for them that they just didn't even bother with one of those three elements. So it, you know, kind of in hindsight, there was some good things that came out of this, whereas, you know, and even beyond just like telehealth or work from home, a lot of these things that really changed the way not only we do business in the medical field, but just across the board. I mean, restaurants don't even have seating anymore. I'm getting too far off here, but the things have really changed as a result of trying to keep that stay at home mentality and not have people crammed in, you know, to these daycare centers and things of that nature. But again, at the end of the day, they didn't have to do that much in order to still get their per diem. And I looked at a lot of these cases over the last couple of years, and a lot of them just frankly didn't do it. There was a few that were pretty good as far as documenting, but do I question whether the documentation represented an actual phone call or a food delivery? Because we would interview members, and a lot of them would say they're billing for these per diem claims 5 days a week, and we talk to the members and they say, well, they don't come every day, they come maybe once a week, or they call every other week. So again, they're very little they had to do to get paid. In most cases, probably 85% of the times, they weren't doing anything.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, when I'm hearing you talk about it, the thing that becomes the biggest challenge is you're looking at these cases in hindsight, and something like a phone call where they're supposed to make a daily phone call, people aren't going to remember that, right? It's a little different if people have to physically go for an appointment. I mean, I remember, I can't tell how many cases I'd work on at the OIG where we would go to the beneficiary's home and say, well, hey, did you go see this doctor on this day? And they would say, hold on, let me get out my calendar. And they would have a physical piece of evidence to show, no, I was on a trip with my family, or I was not at this doctor. Here's my calendar. I write all my appointments down, things of that sort, where that it becomes a challenge, right? A daily phone call. And I know that with things like the meal delivery, one of the workarounds that a lot of these medical daycares were doing was that they would deliver 3, 4, or 5 days worth of meals, right? If they were supposed to provide lunch every day, they would deliver five meals at once and then bill for those five, but it was really once. And, you know, like the rules, if I recall, you couldn't do that, but they would do that as if that was their daily visit, you know. And the sad part is that these people were getting 5 days worth of food on the first day. By day five, you know, who knows if that food's even how it's being stored or what have you. So, you know, it does present. But what you bring up is really the important takeaway is that when there is something that's not as black and white with respect to the rules, you've got to really look to your auditors and your coders about what does the documentation really say, your medical director. And, you know, you have to go to these ancillary people to be able to get these kind of answers. And so I guess I was going to have this for Jason at the end, but I guess it's a good point to talk about now, Jason, which is that from that ROI perspective, when there was so much money being paid out during COVID, it was like, you know, back the money truck up, that, you know, it is important that as part of that understanding of that SIU ROI, and I know we talk about this kind of incessantly, but this brings it right back to home, is the inclusion or the permeation of your auditing, your documentation experts, your clinical staff within payment integrity, that when you've got an instance in which there is a moving ball of a rule, a temporary code, a temporary policy, a waiver of a policy, that the people that have to be kept abreast the most about these things are the auditors. And that becomes one of the most important pieces from that management and ROI perspective.
So, the you know, your point is well taken, and it's really about risk identification, risk assessment, and risk management. So, you know, a significant uptick in billings in more or less a new area of service is an issue. And frankly, you know, with some plans, definitely the federal government in terms of Medicare, somewhat in terms of Medicaid, the approach was, oh my gosh, this is a serious public health concern, which I agree it was and is. But the reality is that rather than engaging the risk, analyzing it, seeing what could be done differently, for instance, are there analytics that could be done? And there were some awesome analytics, frankly, that came as a result of the pandemic. But all that considered, instead, what some plans and some federal and state agencies did is they put a moratorium on dealing with the problem. And so instead of training on it and explaining to staff how to manage the risk, it was really just said, okay, well, we're not going to request provider records during this period or whatever else, as if that's what's going to prevent people from getting the care that they need. So point is that it ultimately is a return on investment, to your point, but it's really about upfront identifying what the factors are and what can be done to mitigate the expenditures of unnecessary resources.
And I think I can put a nice example to that in terms of a change of policy that caused more detailed work to have to be done to get that return on investment. Medicare had a policy in place called the 3-day stay rule that, to be covered in a nursing home, the person had to stay in a hospital for 3 days prior to the nursing home admittance. So before, it was a very easy data dump to see, oh, this person's just been admitted to a nursing home. There's no hospitalization beforehand. We can deny that claim. Data-driven, nothing more needed, no medical review, nothing needed. COVID hit, they waived that requirement. For good reason. You know, they're trying to segregate patients within the nursing home, put some on the skilled side that are catch COVID, so move them away from the general population. Let's waive the hospitalization and just allow for the movement from the regular nursing home to the skilled care. And so there goes that data you know, the data-driven overpayments, because the requirement is gone. But what you then had to look at medically through a medical review was, okay, they moved to the skilled part. Were they getting skilled care, or were they still just getting residential treatment? And so you'd have to look at the what therapy sessions were they getting? What other types of supplemental services were they getting that made it a skilled service rather than just maintenance? And and we were finding huge spikes in the, you know, in the movement of the patients, but we did not see any movement in terms of the level of service that those people were receiving. So it took more of an effort on the SIU's part to identify it and to investigate it, but the ROI was, you know, came back, the return came back, the investment was higher.
Well, and this sort of parlays, Matt, into the part I wanted to talk to you about, which is, you know, we often get asked, how is it that a claim in which the, you know, when we start getting into these telefraud schemes, which became very popular during the PHE and have now continued to go on, right, with genetic testing, the respiratory testing, all of that other stuff, the DME frauds that extended, where, you know, there's the fraud triangle. It's the patient, ordering provider, and then supplier, if it's a lab or something like that. And the question that always comes up is, how is it that data analytics isn't being used to catch? How is it that I get a piece of DME or a genetic test or something, but the ordering physician has, there's no E&M, right? And we know during the PHE that there was a waiver for that. And so the question will always be, and I don't have the answer to this, and I'm hoping someone has the answer, is why is it that nobody is bothering to do this cross-matching of identifying, at least currently, this patient prescriber, patient ordering, and referring, or the lab combination?
I've asked that question of CMS many times. Why can't we put an edit in the system to stop the equipment or the lab test being done when it was ordered by a provider that has no medical billing history with that patient? And the response has been, the provider, whether it's the doctor, DO, whatever it may be, has a year to submit a claim for the patient. So we cannot, in good conscience, deny the claim from the DME company or the laboratory based on the fact that the provider has not submitted his or her claim yet.
Right. And that becomes a tricky thing, right? Because if a DME supplier or a lab or whomever the ancillary provider is, they submit their claim in a really timely manner, right? Mm-hmm. Within a few days or whatever. But the ordering provider decides to wait until the last minute of the 12th month to do it. You can't punish one without, you know, going after the other. And the problem is that after that year, the claim has been paid, and what analytics are you going to run on those things? So it is a very slippery slope in that regard. But, you know, it still then also begs that question in the world of geofencing and geospacing. Like, how is it that, you know, Matt Kachansky, who lives in Florida — you don't, but if you lived in Florida — and the doctor that's ordering the test is in California, and the lab that does the test is in Chicago. I mean, how is it that that doesn't raise an eyebrow, that maybe somebody should be looking at that sooner than later, regardless of whether or not the provider in California has a year to submit the claim? If I'm living, you're living in Florida, and the DME supplier, the lab, the whomever is in Chicago, and there's never been a claim from that lab or that DME supplier or whomever for Matt Kachansky, who's, you know, 1,800 miles away, right? There's a flag to be raised. So while I agree with the premise of this 12-month issue, mm-hmm. which exists, right? There's timely filing, but, you know, in the commercial world, there's that as well. And then there's obviously prompt pay laws that come into play and all of that. So it becomes very complicated, but it's still it still raises up the question of that. So, but in that same vein, let's talk about the fact that when you are going through and doing some of these investigations, you've really got to have a good understanding of what the policy was at the time that the claim was submitted, right? So Wade was having to deal with, you had, forget the CMS policies, Wade was on a state SIU Medicaid team where the policies in that state, as in all states, were really, they were mirroring a lot of the CMS policies, but ever-changing policies on collective payments, on bifurcated payments, on all of that, that you really get into this situation, which I want to kind of, you know, as we get ready to wrap up here, is this whole premise of false positives. And one of the things I know we were talking about before we started this recording was, particularly in the E&M space, which are timed codes, that you're going to get now a lot of false positives, because if data analytics is strictly targeting timed codes and using the CMS estimated time codes, which, by the way, for those of you that are interested, there is an amazing article that was put out in 2013 by the New York Times, where they essentially eviscerated the estimated time code premise that CMS puts out. Absolutely eviscerated it by showing they were doing their research targeted colonoscopies and the estimated time on colonoscopies. And they did a national survey of gastroenterologists and average times. But what we do know is that at least in the estimated average times, those are done by a committee of doctors and they come up with estimated times. And then you've got the AMA's CPT book on actual times. But what we know is that in the E&M world in 2021, the guidelines changed. Time is not a factor. So when we're talking, particularly now, when we're looking at these old COVID cases in which you had a COVID test and you had an E&M, vetting these cases from the beginning, from a data analytics and vetting them for those false positive, really gets back to, as we were talking about with Jason, this premise of the ROI.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you look at things like telehealth. The regulations on telehealth changed more dramatically than any other, I think, during the COVID. Telehealth was a very restricted benefit prior to the PHE, where it had to be from a specific type of place to a specific type of place with the correct equipment in place and all that. All of that got waived.
Origin, you know, site of origin.
A phone call. Yeah,
right? Site of origin and what they stuff. Called... And then what they call the MSA, the Metropolitan Statistical Area. You had to basically be in an underserved area under the Medicare rules, and it was super, super restrictive.
Yes. And if your metrics, if your data analytics are based on any of those regulations, all you're going to get are false positives, because now it's a phone call, you know, and the requirements for that are almost nil.
Right. And Jason, I'll go to you in a second, but I know, you know, we were just talking, one of our SIU clients, their data analytics tool came up with an impossible day involving a provider that had billed for 50 E&Ms in a day, and it was greater than 24 hours in timed codes. And I said, okay, but have you had, you know, any of your auditors, like, what's the documentation saying? Because it's not time focused anymore. And that's the problem, is that analytics are really currently still focusing on the, you know, the timed codes and some of those problems. So Jason, you wanted to say something before we really wrap up?
Well, I just wanted another offer another anecdote. So Washington State is in the Western UPIC jurisdiction. And when COVID hit, and I saw that it was first noticed in a skilled nursing facility in Washington State. I took a look at it, and that facility, it was at the time a 5-star rated facility. And from what I could tell, it wasn't that the 5-star rating wasn't really applicable, or that it was poorly done. Rather, what it was is that there's a change that had to be incorporated into the survey and certification processes, that there needed to be a change in program integrity processes. So it really just gets down to, when you're confronted with a significant turn of events, you need to start to identify how it is you can minimize the organization's risk.
Yeah, sorry, I couldn't get myself off mute there. Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, I this is something I think, you know, we're going to be dealing with this for years to come. I think the PRACS funding was for something like 4 or 5 years. But if history has a way of repeating itself, if we go back and we look at the post-Afghanistan and Iraq There was the special IG for Iraq and Afghanistan reconstruction. And then if you go even further back in 2008 to the special IG for troubled asset relief, SIGTAR, you know, those IGs were only supposed to be in existence for 4 or 5 years. I think SIGTAR still exists, and that dates back to 2008. So, you know, this is ongoing. I think SIUs are at a point now where they're learning the best practices that came about as a result, because nobody really knew what was happening at the time. So, you know, I think the take home for me and the check marks for SIUs are to stay vigilant on your data analytics and really take things with a grain of salt. But also, when you're looking at a case, really be cognizant of the time period of the alleged conduct as it relates to the policies. And I will say this, and this may not be a popular thing to say, but if you've got an instance where policies were confusing, overlapping, and changing, you might want to reconsider how you're going to treat that case. If you've got the instances, particularly with telehealth during the COVID time period, where I can think of at least two policies that were put in place, and there might have even been more with respect to the billing and E&M for COVID on the CMS side, that presents itself with problems. Because if we're confused trying to identify from the SIU perspective and the plan perspective what policy was in place, when, where, why, how, and all of that, then you can be assured that the provider community is equally as confused. Now, again, we're not talking about those that are looking to commit fraud, right? We're not talking about the fraudsters, so to speak, those that were intent on creating a scheme to commit fraud. We're talking about the providers who are submitting claims in that waste abuse piece, where maybe it really is a waste abuse or just lack of understanding or knowledge of the policy. So you've got to really take a look at these things and how you treat them. Is the juice worth the squeeze? Is the ROI worth it on that? You know, there's going to be a lot more. We're seeing a lot of these prosecutions coming out. A lot of these prosecutions are really in the criminal side and the civil side, really things that involve malfeasance versus just a misunderstanding of a policy or a procedure. So you've got to be really cognizant. And that's why having that auditing and that coding team embedded and intrinsically involved as part of that communication, you shouldn't have to be spending a lot of time trying to figure this out. There are people that are in that room that should be the knowledgeable people on these things to help you with those. So to be continued. I hope we gave people a little bit of information to help to make, maybe not make their jobs easier, but at least maybe give some clarity to their jobs. So hopefully, you know, we'll see that. Again, thanks as always for tuning in. Next week, we've got our LinkedIn Live coming up. It's going to be a great one. I'm going to be moderating a discussion with two great lawyers involving the case of U.S. v. Paulus, who is an interventional cardiologist who was criminally prosecuted for medically unnecessary stents. Really interesting case that we here at Advise were involved with. So looking forward to that. We've got our May LinkedIn Live lined up already. We're going to be doing a whole discussion regarding auditing, coding, and investigating as it relates to behavioral health. So please tune in for that. Sign up through our LinkedIn link. Again, if you're not getting our newsletter, you can join us by sending an email to hello@advise, advizehealth.com. You can catch all of our old LinkedIn Live recordings recorded for everybody for later on, as well as our weekly OIG roundtables on our YouTube and our Spotify channel. So again, it's great having you guys, and we'll see you all on the next OIG roundtable.
Thank you.
Thank you.